You went all the way around.
I'll just let it go and re-log in when the time's all.
Good afternoon. First of all, welcome to the Subcommittee on Water. This is March 18th. This afternoon, we're going to hear two small bills, and we have a quorum, so we're going to move through those relatively quickly because our authors need to move on to other committees and present other bills. And then we will hear from the Department of Health and from the Met Council this afternoon. And so once that is done, we will have really gone through all of the governor's recommendations. And as before, we'd like to try to get out of here by 4:30 so that you can enjoy what's left of this lovely day. So without further ado, the first item on our agenda is Senate File
183,
and we have Senator Olson with us. Welcome, Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate File 183 is funding to allow grants to be made by the Star Lakes Board that was created by this body last session. And before I begin describing the bill briefly, I'd like to offer the A1 amendment to put the bill in the shape I'd like to have to have it considered. This is its first stop, so this would be an author's amendment.
Is there someone who will?
I'll move it.
Senator Chaudhry moves the A1 amendment.
And, Madam Chair, essentially what the A1 amendment does is it just adds additional language to the appropriation to meet what I understand is a requirement of the Environmental Committee to have basically some more accountability into how these funds would be used. And so it basically indicates the purpose and to meet that requirement. The Star Lakes Board, if you will recall, was created last session to recognize and incentivize local lake associations to engage in best practices for lake management. And we set up a number of criteria, including a requirement that there had to be at least 50% membership of people who lived on the lake, and also that there had to be a lake management plan that met certain standards. I'm very happy to report that the board membership and the progress that's been made by that board, I think, has really been remarkable in a short period of time. They had their first meeting last October. They were incorporated by the end of the year. They have all of their representatives on board and are actively working on the specific criteria so that they can put guidelines out for lake associations that want to apply for membership, and they're very actively engaged in that process. I think they've also been very responsible in how they've managed the money that they were given so far. They actually haven't hired an executive director even yet because they've had such good participation on a volunteer basis by the members, the people who became members of the board. So they've been very conservative with the use of the money. But in terms of getting grants from legacy money, I would offer this board that this is a very appropriate use of this money, because it's not something that's in the general fund. It certainly wouldn't be backfilling any kind of something that we've traditionally paid for, but it allows the state to get the benefit of many hours of volunteer services and many good behavior practices by investing in the small reward that can be used to these grant allocations to lake associations. And it also allows the local lake association to be very targeted in their use of what would be helpful to cleaning up that particular lake in that area. So with that, members, I'd like to turn over briefly for testimony and questions to a presentation from Mr. Dale Gustafson, who is the board president of the New Star Lakes Board.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Dale Gustafson, and I'm happy to be here today to talk about the Star Lakes program and answer any questions you might have. Full-time, I'm a landscape designer, so it's getting pretty busy pretty soon now. We're going to be out doing those things. But my part-time ambitions really is what got me to be involved in this organization. I was appointed by the Bowser Group to be their designated member on the board because of my years of service in the county where I have a small lake property, and I've been very active in my lake association and very active on the state Minnesota Waters Board and other agencies, and working in whatever we can do to improve the quality of the lake. So I think I kind of typify the need that's out there, and this program we're really excited about because it does provide opportunities to do just that, to really help make a difference. We feel that the Star Lake Board, this new initiative, is just really consistent with what the public voted for when they passed the amendment. It's a way to really help out, particularly for the people that care and are actually doing things to make it better on these lakes and rivers. It's a perfect fit with the strategy of the Minnesota Water Council in that we really have a situation where we can engage the participation of those that are working in and around and on the waters of the state of Minnesota. And it's uniquely statewide. We don't have a particular area that we're meeting. It is Minnesota Star Lakes and Rivers and all of those groups that are working on all of our bodies of water in the state. So it's statewide from that standpoint, which gives us a good fit. We envision this as kind of an incentive and reward system. The reward system would be in our ability to provide grants to groups that qualify on the original criteria and have established their lake or river management plan and can really come to this board and prove that they've really executed that plan. So we say this is a performance-based opportunity for them. There is some funding involved with it so that they can go beyond where they are. And I don't think we're any different than any other lake or rivers association. There's a huge amount of donation of local dollars to protect the waters. That's how so many of these programs have been facilitated in the past, and this gives an opportunity to say to those groups, here's some help on those issues, and maybe get them over some of the critical issues or critical hurdles of some of the issues that cost a little more money, and they just have a difficult time raising all of that on their own. We intend this Star Lake Board to be extremely cost efficient. Our goal, and we have quite a few volunteers, in fact, we're mostly volunteers, there are a few people who are on staff, are really convinced that the best way to expand the use of this money is to get it in the hands of these volunteers that are already putting in these thousands of hours on these projects and will do what they can on their own and then use the money to get them even farther down the line in protecting our waters. And again, we're intending this to be an outcome-oriented application so that these groups have to really come forward and say, yes, we plan to do this. This is what we've done. We work in real close concert with the other organizations such as the Initiative Foundation and Minnesota Water. So we're teaming up with them. So we're not intending to reinvent anything and, you know, go into training people to do lake management, but we want to reward those bodies that are doing it and also provide the information and encourage other people to get the message out that as citizens with a little help of our fellow taxpayers, we can make a real difference in our Minnesota waters. So we'll be here anytime that you have questions about this and want to hear more, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Gustafson. Are there questions or comments from the committee?
Sure.
Senator Anderson.
Madam Chair, thank you. Thank you for your testimony. And as you know, Senator Olson, I was really supportive of this concept last session when you moved it forward. I'm trying to understand exactly how this money would be used. And, you know, you talked about rewarding groups. Does it just give me a little bit more detail about how you would envision an individual grant going out and what exactly?
Madam Chair, Senator Olson,
Mr. Gustafson.
What we envision in this is that the lakes that would apply, and we already have a bunch of them applying through our website that we've established, they would have to first show that they qualify by the standards that are there. Then they would have to bring to us a project that they envisioned going forth on. And based on the fact that they've done what they said they were going to do and they have a meaningful project to help fund, we would then grant them that status and they would have access to these funds to do that next step.
And Senator Anderson, Madam Chair.
Senator Olson, one thing that we neglected to do is vote on your author's amendment.
Oh.
So, Senator.
Oh, we didn't vote.
We moved it, but we didn't vote. So, All those in favor of the motion to adopt the A1 amendment?
Aye.
Say aye.
Aye.
I have to tell you. Opposed? Same sign. Motion passes.
Thank
you. Excuse me, Senator.
Madam Chair, and of the kinds of projects, to in answer to Senator Anderson's question, there's almost like an unlimited number of potentials. But for example, if there was a number of people in the area that said they wanted to revegetate their shoreline, and they'd explored up other options, and there wasn't going to be the money available to help that, they could apply for a specific grant for that purpose, and they would have already had the people committed to do that, and they would be able to say how much money they needed. Or they might have some kind of a need to identify the source that a pollution was coming in, whether it's coming from, I'm thinking of a number of lakes in my district where there's increased phosphorus levels and a lot of weeds, and they're trying to get to the bottom of what's causing that so that they can address the issue. They might need to hire someone to come in and do some research in that area. And again, if there are other opportunities to pay for that, those would be explored. And the Star Lakes Board will probably would be in a position to point them, because they have memberships representing different groups, to other opportunities. But if there aren't other opportunities, then they'll be kind of uniquely positioned to meet that special need. So I don't know if that answers your question.
Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And then I just want to get a little, that's helpful, and then, you know, what are the standards that would be used to judge which grants would be given, and is there a dollar limit, and would any kind of a local match be needed? Any of those kinds of questions. Have you thought through those kinds of things yet?
Madam Chair.
Mr. Gustafson.
We've been working on exactly that detail and how it's going to fit together, but in a nutshell, we know that, first of all, one of the rating criteria would be how they've used other sources of income. If you take, for example, a project where they need to correct a runoff situation by creating a wetland just outside their lake, there are some funds available for that, certain categories of funding through soil and water and other grant programs. So that goes into part of the ranking that we're envisioning, that, yes, they are capitalizing on everything else that they can get. They also have a project that has demonstrated technology behind it. The exact amount is not really been resolved yet, because we really don't know how much we're going to be dealing with.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Senator Anderson. And I would just say that I don't have the bill from last year right in front of me, but we did put some criteria in that bill that give the board guidance for what the legislature would like them to consider. But then we deliberately set up a process where the board would streamline and kind of refine those criteria, because we wanted them to have that flexibility once we put those experts in place, which I think is what we now have. And so they're trying to come up with some, and they're coming up with some more concrete guidelines for the lake associations in this application process, because that's what the lake associations were asking for. You know, what do we need to do? And so they're going to have materials that can be sent out to the lake associations to assist them with exactly what the expectations will be.
Okay, one more,
Senator
Madam Chair,
Anderson.
If I may. And I'm sorry if you've already gone through the membership of the board. Maybe I missed that. But you said the experts that will be reviewing these. Who will bring the ability to determine if these fulfill scientifically sound management objectives? How do we know that that will be, that level of expertise will be applied to the decision making?
Well, Madam Chair, the people who were appointed to this board, there were appointees from the DNR, Soil and Water, Minnesota Waters. Dan Sims, I know you've met from my area, was one of the appointees. Lake Association members who've been involved in this area in the past. And maybe you can give some more specific details of kind of the expertise and background of some of the board members.
Yes, certainly. We have. We also have a mayor, county commissioner, so we've got people who have served in that capacity and know the details of that. Our staff people are very knowledgeable from the DNR and MPCA, and so those folks bring that expertise, as well as the members that wanted to serve on this board that we selected from around the state. We pretty well cover the entire state, but they've got decades in most cases of service in this area of working with water, and that gives us kind of a real good start as to what's a feasible project, what kind of expenses should there be, and we have all the other programs that are in operation that we can compare against also.
Senator Olson.
Madam Chair and Senator Anderson, just to follow up on that too, I was really impressed to see how many applications there were for positions on this board. I looked at those applications. They were kind enough to share them with me, and I think there were four or five at least applications for every position that was open, so they really did have the ability to choose people with some good credentials. But it's kind of a nice mix between people with some strong business strengths who are making this board, who are being very careful with the money and how it's spent. For example, in rather than hiring an executive director, they've contracted with a nonprofit for some services, so they didn't have to have a full-time employee. They were able to get the incorporation done by utilizing a very inexpensive process that the nonprofit recommended. And then they also have the people with the expertise in water management and the environmental issues. So it's been a nice blend, I think.
Senator Olson, I have a question. How does the Minnesota Star Lakes Board interface with the schedule and procedures that the DNR and the MPCA and the Bowser have set in place for addressing the clean waters, watershed by watershed? Is this above and beyond that schedule, something that you're anticipating their work, or?
Well, Madam Chair, I'm not sure if I understand your question exactly, but if I can just explain what the Star Lakes Board does and how it works. The Star Lakes Board is a nonprofit board made up of these volunteers who receive applications from lake associations that would like to have a Star Lake designation. And then also the legislation says that if they do receive that designation, they may be, it doesn't say they have to be, but they may be prioritized for assistance by those agencies with projects and things that they need help with. And then also there's a component that says that they can oversee a fund, whether it's with state money, private money. Hopefully it's going to be a combination of resources from a number of different sources. And then for lake associations that are successful, be able to make these grants back. So it's really kind of operating on its own, but it has membership from these different agencies, and the people who are either the people who serve as volunteers are either members of those agencies or were appointed by those agencies and have a lot of information about the resources that are available through there, so they can help kind of by integrating that. But it's also the idea is to try to promote the culture of responsible lakeshore management by making it desirable to be a Star Lake. It's enhancing or giving a recognition to the idea that kind of changing the view of what an ideal lake would look like and what an ideal lake lot would be in terms of good lake management practices. So it has kind of multiple components. Does that answer your question?
I think it does. Are there other questions or discussion for? So I think our next
chair,
Senator Anderson.
Are either of you familiar with the Clean Water Partnerships Program that we have at the PCA?
A little bit.
I'm trying to just get it clear in my mind how you would do things similarly or differently than that. And maybe we could always ask them, the agency, to come forward and comment on that. But I'm just trying to understand. If you have any comment about how you'd be same or different in your approach, that would be helpful.
Senator Olson or Mr. Gustafson?
Okay.
Mr. Gustafson.
Madam Chair, In response to that question, partially because of the makeup of this board, unless the program hasn't really been announced yet, this group pretty much knows all the programs that are out there just from experience. And their particular group or the people that they work with are seeking this additional funding. And so we see this as being a little bit unique. Where there aren't opportunities, we can endorse and help them get those things completed. We have a very tight relationship with all of the agencies and simply do not intend to duplicate anything along those lines. We had envisioned that there might be sort of a scoring thing that we could pass on to the DNR and MPCA and say, this group is a Star Rivers group or a Star Lake group, and that could be put in their application so that it might help them in getting some of that funding if that's where they wanted their monies to go.
Senator Olson.
And Madam Chair, I think another difference is that this has a prerequisite before there can be any kind of grant made. There has to be a certain behavior that occurs first. And so it's not, we need the money for this project, but it's also, we've been willing to do this first, and or we are in the process of doing these things, so we're not asking you, the state, or you, a particular agency, to come and fix this problem for us. We're doing these things to fix this problem for ourselves, and we just need this bit of help from you, or, you know, so it's really a reward for very time-intensive behavior on the part of the Lake Association, a commitment they've made in order to be considered for that grant.
Mr. Gustafson.
Madam Chair, just kind of an example of how that might happen. In some of the programs that we have, it's clear that we don't have enough money to solve the problems. So lake associations and river associations that have been actively working on it, their problem might not be quite as bad as some of the others that have been neglected. And the agencies that get the initial funding that we are able to provide them, and I assume it'll be less in future years, they only have so much to go around. So some of these lakes that are really working hard don't qualify because their problem isn't bad enough. It's a problem. It needs to be fixed. Our lake is a real good example of that. We've been sort of skipped over on a couple programs, but yet we were trying desperately to make an improvement as to where we are. So it gives opportunities for lakes that don't fit in the other funding that's already in the channels.
Madam Chair.
Senator Anderson.
Mr. Gustafson, do you mind telling me which programs you're just as examples, not to pick on anybody or anything, but just so we can understand where there might where a lake like yours might not fit in an existing program?
A good example would be there. We've done a couple projects around our lake to clean up the water before it gets there. These are runoffs from roads, whether they're township roads or county roads or some other farming issue, and there just isn't funds to go around to fund all of those projects. Our particular lake is trying to get in line for the study that we need to do to qualify for the status of our lake. Those funds are limited. The best example I can think of is the DNR has a program where they're trying to support whole bay or whole lake treatments where there's a critical invasive species. And last year they were able to have 8 lakes in that fund. Next year they hope to have 16 lakes. 16 out of hundreds doesn't get us there very quickly. So some of our applications may be along that line. But the key thing is it's local concern, local issues, so it gets defined. It doesn't have to fit into this one back category. It's what that lake really needs to do, or that river.
Senator Olson.
Madam Chair and Senator Anderson, but I would also say that there are people on that board that would make sure that it's also something that's scientifically a justifiable use of the expenditure. You know, there's sometimes a difference between what a lake association might like to do and what science supports in terms of an effective use of that money. And so that's why we've got that balance on the board, I think, to make sure that we're not going to be spending money on things that are not scientifically really justifiable.
Madam Chair.
Senator Anderson.
Would you like a motion to lay this on the table for possible inclusion in the...
I was just about to ask for that.
I would move that.
So we have a motion to lay Senate File 183 as amended on the table for possible inclusion in the subcommittee's Clean Water Fund proposal to the full budget subdivision. All those in favor of the motion say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion passes.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Senator. Thank you, Mr. Gustafson. We have Senator Erickson Ropes here with us, and she's going to bring us a proposal, Senate File 1086. Welcome, Senator.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't think I've ever been before you, Senator Remmer. So
I'm still very new at this and pretty clumsy.
I'm sure that's not true. Well, I'm very happy to be before you today in the subcommittee with a great project for southeastern Minnesota. I have with me today Rich Biskey, who's the Southeastern Minnesota Conservation Coordinator for the Nature Conservancy. And we have a really good project dealing with watersheds for the Root River area. And this area down southeastern Minnesota covers about a million acres. And we've, or Mr. Biskey actually, and his partnership have identified three local watershed projects that they want to do some testing and monitoring on so we can justify with science and measurement and numbers some of the best practices that the farmers are using now down there to find out what is really working and what still needs to be done. So I will have Mr. Biskey talk to you about some of those the projects. The good news is, in terms of funding, that the Nature Conservancy has already pledged $500,000 to this project. And we're asking the state then for less than that, $395,000. So, Mr. Biskey, would you introduce yourself?
Thank you, Madam, and members. Our project...
Mr. Biskey, would you state your name for the record, please?
Sure. It is Richard Biskey.
Thank you.
Nature Conservancy.
Go ahead.
What our project is to evaluate watersheds at a different scale. All too often, how we manage our watersheds is we monitor at hundreds of thousands of acres. And at that scale, it's difficult to tell what specifically some of those issues are or where they're coming from, but it's also difficult to tell some of the good things that are happening in that watershed, the farmers that are doing the right things, and how are they doing that. And so what our project looks at is three representative watersheds of southeast Minnesota. It's in the flat country, you know, where a lot of tile drainage and ditch systems are, a bluffland area where we have sinkholes and springs, and then where we have very steep ravines towards the east. And we'll monitor less than 5,000 acres at a time. But within those, we have several farms that we'll monitor. The sizes vary from 80 acres to 200 acres. And so we can tell exactly what's coming off of those fields, specifically and for nutrients, for soil. And we can do that and establish a baseline. And then as we implement conservation practices or best management practices, we can identify the true benefits of those practices as a way to inform which ones we think we should invest in the future and which ones we should promote locally with landowners. It's a very much a ground-up approach involving those landowners as well.
Thank you, Mr. Biskey.
Biskey.
Biskey. Thank you. Are there questions or comments? As I'm hearing you, it sounds like what you're really doing is some science for us.
But it's also implementing locally led best management practices.
So you're going to implement them and monitor them, you said, on a different scale than we typically do this?
Correct, ma'am.
Can you tell us more about how you're going to do that?
Madam, implementing the best management practices?
And how you're going to monitor them on this smaller scale?
Absolutely. Where the fields are, they funnel to a point. And we establish monitoring equipment at that point. So all water drains to that point at any given scale. So we will monitor that at that small watershed perspective, but we'll also take samples within a field. So it's, we get technical, but it's soil conditioning index, phosphorus index, and nitrate sampling of corn. so we can tell and inform those producers if they're applying too much fertilizer or their soils are eroding, you know, based on the organic matter. And we can use that information to work with farmers to alter their nutrient management, the fertilizers they're applying.
And, Madam Chair, I understand this is one of the first of its kind projects that's been proposed for the state. Mr. Biskey says he doesn't know of any other local watershed project of this kind of proposal. So it would give us new information. And for many years, farmers have been putting in these best practices, whether they're grass buffer strips or windbreaks or all sorts of collection systems to control soil and water erosion and runoff. But this actually would give us some numbers saying that this particular practice produces this kind of results.
Thank you, Senator. Is there someone here from the Department of Agriculture?
While they're walking up, Madam Chair, I'll just say that Mr. Biskey tells me he's had a good partnership with the Department of Ag, and is also working with a local staff from the Soil and Water Conservation District, the local DNR staff, and the Extension Service has been really helpful as well. So
that's terrific. Will you state your name for the record?
Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Joe Martin, Assistant Commissioner with the Minnesota Department of Agriculture.
Welcome. Can you give us some perspective on how this will affect the Department of Agriculture?
Madam Chair, members, as was stated, we have had dialogue with Nature Conservancy on this project dating back for quite some time. The goals of this project are very good, and actually it was part of a original LCCMR proposal that was put together on behalf of TNC and department. Unfortunately, it wasn't funded. And I think, like I said, the goals of the project are good. In terms of our Clean Water Fund request, as you can see, our request is vague on purpose. We haven't endorsed any individual projects per se, but I would say that this project definitely fits within the parameters of the type of work that we that would want to be involved in the future.
Are there any?
We should know if it's going to be a grant or not, because it doesn't say that in the language.
Thank you. The question is, will this be a grant? Do you have how will these dollars be used or dispersed?
Madam Chair, members, we'd have to have additional conversations in terms of how it would be structured and who would be the fiscal agent within the watershed.
Senator Erickson-Ropes, do you know any more about how the dollars will be dispersed? Or?
I don't. I've been working with, Tim Terrell. He's a soil and water conservation director in Winona County. And he has talked to me on another project about their interest in being a fiscal agent or dealing with some of the grants that might be available through legacy funding in terms of local control of that money. So there's a possibility there. I haven't discussed it in detail with anyone, so I don't have anything to offer significant to that point today.
As I understand...
Go ahead.
I was going to... Did you have a...
Senator
Anderson.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. And I remember this project sort of from the LCCMR discussion, but not very much. So trying to understand how it would work. What type of water body, I mean, you're going to be testing the runoff from a particular field into a body of water? Did I understand that correctly?
Madam Chair, members.
Or on the field. You're just going to be testing the corn. That wasn't quite clear.
Madam Chair, members, the answer is D, all of the above. It's at the edge of the field, within the field, and then at that watershed, so in the stream.
And how big is a sub-watershed that you're looking at?
The field edges, so we'll start from smallest and go up, Madam Chair and members. It's at the field scale is at 80 acres. The watersheds themselves are less than 5,000. They range in size of 3,200 acres to about 4,800 acres in size.
Okay, Madam Chair, can you put that in perspective? I'm not good at acres, so how many farm fields is that, or how far is that in feet along a water body, along a stream? Can you give me a guess?
Madam Chair and members, that would be approximately 2 miles along a stream.
Okay. And so, Madam Chair, are these fields that you're going to be testing along a stream, or is it a ditch, or what kind of water body are you looking at? Are there tributaries of the river?
Mr. Biskey.
Madam Chair, members, these are, so at the field level, it's a grassed waterway. It's a funnel point within that field, and then within the stream, it's a tributary stream to the Root River.
And so, Madam Chair,
Senator Anderson,
so you're going to be testing the numbers, what's the percent or what's the amount of some of these components that are going into the water? But I remember we've had discussion about this before. Since we're not the Ag Committee, we don't get into it as much as we should because there's a lot of overlap here in this discussion. But I remember hearing someone say, you can't measure non-point runoff. You can't. You just can't do it because you just can't account. You just have one space and time that you're measuring, but you can't really look at what's upstream or downstream, well, upstream anyway. So this is upstream? Is that the point? This is at the top of the chain?
Madam Chair, members, it is at the very top of the watershed.
And, Madam Chair, this is not being done anywhere else? I mean, if we don't fund this project, is that kind of testing of best management practices or evaluation being done?
Madam Chair, members, the area of BMP effectiveness is an area with a lot of knowledge gaps. We've prescribed BMPs for many years, but to quantify the water quality benefit from an actual BMP, there are still a lot of questions, and I think that's part of what this effort, and yes, there are other research projects that Department of Ag has been involved in with the university. I think what the area we're entering into now is we've had BMPs for a long time. Now we need to use technology and monitoring to better identify where on the landscape a BMP needs to be placed and what benefit you're going to get from it.
Madam Chair.
Senator Anderson.
Mr. Martin, I really appreciate your explanation because I've heard on the one hand, you can't measure it. On the other hand, our best management practices are all research tested, so trust me. And there are some gaps, and that really does make sense what you're saying, that we need to, you know, just hone in on them more. And I'm sure they are research tested, but perhaps not to the scale that we need to be able to put all this money out there we're putting out for a lot of practices that maybe we need a little more information about their whether they'll be successful or not.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
In our Ag Committee, we are having some conversation about conservation plans for farms. There's a bill out there that hasn't been passed yet. Senator Dill and Mr. Knopf and Mr. Mueller have heard this bill. But there is some movement to look at individual farms having a conservation plan. And this would give us some data to say this practice produces X amount of results. And so we could move forward with better recommendations on conservation.
I'm going to ask Mr. Knopf to... He has a question about the appropriation of $395,000 to the Department of Agriculture.
Well, Madam Chair and Mr. Martin, right now the language of the bill says it's to the Commissioner of Agriculture to monitor agricultural non-point source pollution and implement best management practices. It sounds like the Commissioner is going to do these things, or at least somebody from the Department. Generally, if we're going to grant to an organization outside, we'd say that in the language. Do you know if it's the intent of the Department to actually be involved directly in this, or would it be granted to a third party? Because we should include that in the language if that's the case.
Madam Chair and members,
Mr. Martin,
we have not evaluated this particular piece of legislation or taken a position on it, but in past practice, when we've had these type of pass-throughs, it's usually best to name an entity to work through.
Mm-hmm. So, Madam Chair, I guess the point is that you can amend it now, or if it gets in an omnibus bill later, we should probably have something in there. Maybe the Soil and Water Conservation District, or whoever's going to be implementing this at the local level, be the grantee for this money.
Is that something, and, Mr. Martin?
Madam Chair, I'd say in cases where an entity is not named, where we would have language like that many times, we would probably issue an RFP based on what the outcomes we'd want, and then have entities apply to awards. So.
But, Madam Chair, Mr. Martin, at a minimum, we should say it's for grants then, because I don't think you have granting authority without that language.
Thank you, Mr. Knopf. Mr. Martin?
Madam Chair, either way works.
So, Senator Erickson-Robes, do you want to change the language here? As I understand it, we are hearing this for information right now, because it will
That's
be
right.
heard in the Department of the Ag Committee. Or do you want to work on that? So when you bring it to the Ag Committee, you've got that added in?
I'll be happy to work with Mr. Knopf on that.
So, Madam Chair,
Senator Anderson.
Is this bill actually in your subcommittee or in our division and in the Ag Division at the same time?
Okay. Right now.
So I don't know if it would be appropriate to lay this on the table. I suppose we could, as long as we've got it, and then they can review it, and then we'll talk. Is that the plan?
Yes.
Do you want to make that motion,
sure,
Senator Anderson?
I will. I will move that Senate File 1086 be laid on the table and recommended for possible inclusion in the subcommittee omnibus water bill.
All those in favor, is there a discussion on the motion?
Well,
Senator Dill.
Madam Chair, I have a comment, but since it's a tabling, you're moving to table, I don't think discussion is appropriate, is it?
In committee,
well,
it's fine.
He says in committee it's okay, and he knows.
Yeah, I think it's fine.
Well, I just want to thank Senator Erickson-Robes for bringing this forward, because this is something I'm very interested in. And I know there's a lot of information out there as to how some of these best management practices work, but it doesn't seem to me that there's enough. And so I'm very happy to spend some more money to find out how much these buffer strips do, how much restored wetlands do in different situations, conservation tillage, livestock grazing, temporarily and mm-hmm. along streams to harvest the vegetation, to get them out of there and so forth after they harvest the vegetation. So I think that this is a good place to spend some money.
On the motion, all those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion passes.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, Committee.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Erickson-Robes and Mr. Biskey and Mr. Martin. For this part of the agenda, we are going to hear the rest of the governor's recommendations. We'll be hearing from the Department of Health and also from the Med Council. And I think we have with us Mr. John Stein to start us off. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is John Langstein. I'm the Assistant Commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Health, and you'll notice a number of other state agency staff are here, and we're going to share in the participation of this presentation today. We appreciate the invitation to speak to you, and I'll begin, but we're also going to have Mr. Martin from the Department of Agriculture, Mr. Japs from the Department of Natural Resources, Ms. Lodhammer from the Pollution Control Agency, and then wrap up with Mr. Elverum from the Met Council. So we've worked to consolidate our presentation, similar to the presentation you heard on Monday, so that we can be efficient and respond to as many questions as possible. This is just the overall summary of what's in the governor's Clean Water Fund proposal among a variety of different activities. Clearly, these are joint efforts of the seven agencies that were listed on the title slide: the Pollution Control Agency, DNR, Agriculture, Health, the Board of Water and Soil Resources, Public Facilities Authority, and the Met Council. And I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this today other than to note that we're going to focus today on the last bullet in this presentation, which is the drinking water protection proposal for approximately $9 million. Breaking down that $9 million within the governor's proposal, and I believe you have a copy of my slides. It should look like this. Okay, good. Thank you. And the fund for drinking water protection breaks down across the five agencies in the way described on this slide, and we're going to get into each one of those expenditures in some detail today. First of all, I want to spend a little time about this graphic, which I really appreciate. Laurel Reeves from the DNR put this together, and it's a helpful description about how we address groundwater, because many times there's a lot of confusion over the roles and responsibilities of state agencies for groundwater. Not shown on this slide is the Metropolitan Council, but the Metropolitan Council also has a role in planning and evaluating water supply and water supply availability and plans for water supply in the metropolitan area. So this slide is just sort of a helpful description of where the Department of Agriculture plays a role, where the Department of Health plays a role, where the Pollution Control Agency and the DNR all play roles. There are a number of different wells out on the landscape used for a variety of different purposes, and frequently there are folks who believe that we're all chasing each other around the state, wasting time and not being effective and efficient in using people's resources, but there are a variety of different purposes that each of those wells serve, and they're not all the same wells, I can tell you that. Where there might be a contamination of groundwater, that would be the Department of Agriculture's responsibility or the Pollution Control Agency's responsibility. Where it has to do with a drinking water supply for a community, that's generally the Department of Health's responsibility. DNR has a role in evaluating the quantity of water that's available for a variety of purposes, ranging from human use and consumption for business and industry to supplies for the environment. So those purposes, while they interact and intermingle, are not at cross purposes. We want to talk about drinking water sources today, and this is part of the presentation that I made a couple of weeks ago in the committee, and I just wanted to remind you that where people get their drinking water in this state. This is about a total of 5.2 million people in the state. 1.3 drink community surface water. 2.7 million Minnesotans drink their water from community wells, and then the remainder drink water from private wells. And many times folks are unfamiliar with where people who are drinking surface water live. That's primarily the core cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul. They're supplied by the Mississippi River and surrounding suburbs. Several communities along the Red River of the North obtain their water from the Red River or tributary rivers because there is not an adequate or long-term quantity available from groundwater in those areas. City of Duluth and many of the North Shore communities, and then resorts and communities in the Arrowhead and Iron Range part of the state get their water from surface water. We want to talk about the outcomes among all the agencies that we're going to describe today in the governor's recommendations. And these are the outcomes that we'll be talking about. Mr. Martin will tell you about increased nitrate monitoring and investigation remediation of groundwater as a result of agricultural activities. We're going to talk about expanded emerging contaminant research that will be going on among a variety of agency efforts led by the Minnesota Department of Health. We're going to talk about the Department of Health's accelerated wellhead protection efforts, and then the expansion of water supply evaluation and protection. And Madam Chair and members, what you'll hear is that these are supplemental to, not supplanting existing resources in our view. This is a description of the wellhead protection plans that have been developed in the state, and you may or may not know that wellhead protection plans are developed by the Department of Health with extensive community participation. We developed the plans in a phased approach across the state based on the vulnerability of a community's water supply, their well, and the population that is served. Those two things together help us evaluate the public health risk that may be present. And we look at that, and the greater the vulnerability, the greater the population, the sooner we work on the wellhead protection plan. So what you're seeing in the development of these plans are the most populated communities with the most vulnerable water supplies are the first ones through the process. The governor's recommendations are to increase our funding over the upcoming biennium by $2.415 million to accelerate the development of wellhead protection plans and complete them more quickly. The plans then must be updated on a 10-year cycle. The funding for this effort would also include funding to assist local units of government in adopting ordinances and plans and providing them with technical assistance.
Assistant Commissioner, excuse me for interrupting. So what are some of the conditions that make a particular wellhead vulnerable?
The proximity of the aquifer to the surface of the ground, the inventory of potential sources of contamination, they may be pipelines, buried tanks, existing contaminants that were disposed of at earlier times that are now seeping into groundwater and migrating through the water system. And maybe I can refer you, Madam Chair, to this map of the city of Gaylord, which is a good example of what we do when we develop a wellhead protection plan. We identify the well, which is the three dots in the, you can not see them very well at this scale, but in the lower right-hand corner of that red circle, if you will, there's three dots. Those are the community's wells. The blue line indicates the area that contributes water to those wells over time, and that is called the wellhead protection area. The red line outlines the emergency response area. That's the area where water would very quickly migrate to the well, and if anything were to happen in terms of a spill, some kind of a break in a pipeline, any kind of event that could introduce a contaminant into the water supply, it would move quickly into the system and pose public health risk. So that's the area where special consideration is giving to management of the land use and of activities near those wellheads. The green line then is the area that has, because it identifies a political boundary, the area that the community then adopts some kind of plan or zoning controls for that area. So again, depending upon the vulnerability, the population served, the wellhead protection plan is a tool that the communities then use to set their plans for land use in the future, because what we do at the surface of the land is what we end up drinking one day. An overgeneralization, but it's good to remember that land use affects groundwater.
Madam Chair.
Senator Anderson.
Well, I have a couple questions. One is, if you go back a page to the numbers there.
Yes.
And you said 27. This is just for public community wells, right?
These are for the community water supplies, yes.
And Madam Chair, that's 2.7 million Minnesotans. How many of those are there around the state, community public wells?
Roughly 1,000 water supplies. That's roughly 1,000 community water supply systems. They range in size from a mobile home park to the city of Minneapolis.
So, Madam Chair, by the time you get to 1,200 plans, you should have covered the whole state.
That's correct, Madam Chair.
Okay. And then second question, Madam Chair.
Senator Anderson.
Is you identified, you know, what you look at in a plan, but is this funding just to write the plan, or is the funding to actually do something to implement it?
Madam Chair and Senator Anderson, the money is to do the groundwater modeling, to know where the water is coming from to the well. Most communities have not developed a model to assess the sources and the flow pattern in the aquifer. There is funding provided to develop the plans and the ordinances and then to educate the community and the community leaders about this, the risk to public health that would exist. Cleaning up is a source. We look to other programs and other sources of funds. There have been some good success stories where, for example, nitrates have been a risk for community water supply contamination, where we can use some funds through the Board of Water and Soil Resources RIM program to set aside lands and take it out of production, perhaps, so that the ongoing source of nitrates, if that's the threat, can be eliminated. So there are other programs then that come in to supplement any activities that might be needed. Similarly, if there's a contaminant source that's a Superfund site or some other disposal action that's resulted in contamination, there are pollution control agency programs and other funds that can be used to address those concerns.
Thank you. Go on, Mr. Stein.
Thank you. The other component of funding is just an example of our emerging contaminant research. This is a slide showing the perfluorochemical contamination of groundwater in the East Metro area in Washington County. And the reason I show this is to demonstrate the work that we sometimes in the Department of Health are called upon to do to figure out newly identified and unregulated contaminants in drinking water. Perfluorochemicals were not viewed as a regulated contaminant under the Safe Drinking Water Act. There's no health risk numbers that were established, and the department, when these compounds were found in the drinking water in Washington County, set aside a lot of work, ongoing work, on our health risk limits and on our health-based values for drinking water to investigate this problem. There are unregulated contaminants about which there are many concerns. Those compounds that can be endocrine disruptors, personal care products, pharmaceuticals are examples of those kinds of products. And there is very limited funding in our budget at this time to examine those risks. And so the governor's proposal is to invest a total of $1.335 million in fiscal year 10 and 11 to look at these contaminants of emerging concern. I'm going to move on to the Department of Agriculture's portion of the presentation, invite Mr. Martin to the table to give you a little bit of background on their proposals.
Thank you. Welcome back, Mr. Martin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Joe Martin. I serve as Assistant Commissioner with the Minnesota Department of Ag. The next two slides are very general. And I'll keep my comments pretty general in terms of the work that we propose to do. If there's some technical questions of more specifics what we do, I do have a staff member in the room who could answer those. The first slide you'll see is probably better titled Goals. The request is in the governor's budget is $1.125 million for nitrate work at the Department of Ag. We know that nitrates have been a problem and a concern throughout Minnesota for many years, and it's primarily due to fertilizer use. What we propose to do with the additional funding is, obviously, the goal is to reduce the leaching of nitrates from fields into groundwater, and we would do this by working more on you heard more about best management practices. Really what it comes down to is soil type and crops grown and doing that type of analysis of what's the optimum fertilizer application rates in areas that may be experiencing problems. And really what it comes down to is when we need to work with the local communities when there is problems identified, and basically bringing farmers, the community, and the suppliers together to address them. The next slide is a little more detailed of actually what the actions we would take. It's intuitive that we would increase monitoring in areas to identify if we know that there are some communities have problems ready. We'd want to do some additional monitoring in areas to identify new areas potentially to work in. We'd want to we don't have grant funding right now really in terms of working with local communities, so a portion of this money would actually be available for grants for local communities who want to be proactive and working to reduce nitrate problems. We'd also work on updating the nitrogen fertilizer management plan, and that's really a plan that talks about application rates throughout the state in terms of soil type and crop use. And then lastly, we'd partner with the Ag Statistics Service to really get a better picture of how much fertilizer farmers around the state are using for particular soils and crops. So that concludes my remarks.
Are there questions for Mr. Martin?
I have a question.
Senator Dill.
Madam Chair, Mr. Martin, do you know how many cases of methemoglobinemia there's been in the state in babies under the age of 1 year in recent years?
Madam Chair and Senator Deal, that's really a question for the Department of Health, because we would be the ones who would hear about that. I don't have the specific answer to that question, but we do. I know we've had some anecdotal reports from the past. I believe the last reported case, if I'm remembering correctly, Larry, was from the 90s. I heard this from one of my staff members. So, Senator Deal, I have to follow up with you on that.
Well, Madam Chair, members, my impression is that it happens very rarely, and it may have been a long time since the last case was diagnosed. And of course, we have a drinking water standard of 10 parts per million for nitrates, and occasionally a well does get above that. But it appears to cause no problem in human beings over a year of age. And if they're under a year of age and they're nursing their mother, it's not a problem either. It's if they're using that milk for reformulating the formula for the baby. So it's kind of a rare thing. Now, the other part that we have to be concerned about is the nitrates going down the river and heading for the Gulf of Mexico. But my understanding is the readings in the rivers, the Minnesota River and the Mississippi River, very rarely gets above 10 parts per million. So it's within drinking water standards. But somehow when it gets down the Gulf of Mexico, it still causes this problem with the dead zone. And so it's a concern that way. But I just try to put the whole thing in perspective. It's something to think about, but it's maybe not as bad as some people think it is.
Madam Chair, if I could just comment too, that every new well that's constructed is tested for nitrate, and every community water supply is regularly tested for nitrates, so that the community can be informed or the property owner can be informed about how to reduce the risk of exposure for pregnant women or newborns for nitrates. That is the program that we operate with the well drilling community in the state, and it is our goal to not see anyone exceed that exposure limit. So once we find a level higher than that in a well, we immediately work with the family or the property owner to give them advice how to reduce their exposure.
Thank you, Assistant Commissioner. Is there any other questions for Assistant Commissioner Martin?
Well, Madam Chair.
Senator Anderson.
I'm wondering if all of these are new activities or already being funded by the department, and how they go above and beyond what you're already doing.
Mr. Martin.
Madam Chair, if I could I ask Dan Stoddard from our pesticide and fertilizer division to address that question?
Yes, you can. Please give your name for the record.
Excuse me, Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Dan Stoddard. I'm Assistant Director in the Pesticide and Fertilizer Management Division. Madam Chair, Senator
Anderson.
Could
you bring the mic a little closer?
Oh, sorry. My name is Dan Stoddard. I am Assistant Director in the Pesticide and Fertilizer Management Division. Madam Chair, Senator Anderson, to answer your question, we do have staff, and we are doing some of this work. In fact, we're the lead agency for regulating and managing nitrogen fertilizer. We have developed a response plan called the Nitrogen Fertilizer Management Plan. That plan has been in place since 1990, and that was developed with the input of many different parties and agencies. The plan's a good one, but it's getting a little old. We really haven't had a lot of staff to move forward with implementing some of the requirements in the plan. Our resources have been very limited. So this would be for additional resources to implement that plan and do some of the work we feel needs to be done to address nitrates in groundwater. Nitrates are fairly commonly found in groundwater across the state in shallow aquifers, and we do think it's a concern.
Okay. And then, Madam Chair,
Senator Anderson?
At the four bullets, and that was one of the bullets. I'm not sure if you're involved with all four of these. The fourth one is about trends in fertilizer practices. Is that under your purview, Mr. Stutter?
Madam Chair, Senator Anderson? Yes, all of these activities are under our lead role. Are you looking at the one increased monitoring, or which specific bullet are you looking at, ma'am?
The last one.
Well, Madam Chair, I'm looking for an answer on all four of them, honestly, so if they're all under your...
I can walk through them then.
Please.
We do work with other agencies in monitoring, but this is kind of a small-scale monitoring activity where areas that have elevated nitrates, we would go in and we would work usually with homeowners, and there might be other partners, so we work with whoever makes sense. to develop a citizen monitoring kind of approach so we can evaluate changes in water quality over time. And the purpose is obviously to determine whether or not the best management practices to protect groundwater are actually having the desired effect.
And Madam Chair, Mr. Stoddard, are you doing any of that now?
Madam Chair, Senator Anderson, we have worked on a number of projects that have been successful. Assistant Commissioner Stein mentioned work in source water protection areas. We have a number of case studies where there were community water supply wells that had elevated nitrates, and we went in and worked with the local grower groups, the other state agencies, the local units of government, and developed a response plan. We did survey work of actual agricultural practices, so we knew what the practices were in those areas, and then we used that information to help obtain funding and to determine what best management practices are optimum for that specific location. And that's the kind of approach that we would want to take in areas that had specific problems, such as source water protection areas.
Madam Chair and Senator Anderson,
Mr. Stein.
I think your question is, how much of this are they doing right now, and how much would this augment what they're doing right now? And I believe if I'm understanding Mr. Stoddard correctly, is they're able to conduct this on a kind of an as-identified kind of basis right now. This would augment the funding at the department to actually increase their monitoring levels of activity and then engage in additional communities. Am I saying that correctly,
Madam Chair,
Dan?
That's correct. Basically, to do more. Our resources have been very limited. But we do have experience in doing this, and we have some success stories. Madam Chair, would you like me to continue with the last two bullets?
Did you want?
All right. Same concept. Basically, first, we would like to revise and update the nitrogen fertilizer management plan. We think the plan is a good one, but it's pretty old. And what we would do is have a public stakeholder process and bring in all the interested parties to do that. And finally, we would like to partner with the National Agricultural Statistics Service to do a survey of agricultural best management practices. The cost to do this, we think, is pretty reasonable, but it provides very significant value in determining on a large scale what farmers actually do with respect to adopting best management practices, and also whether they're changing their practices, whether we need to look at new activities and possibly come up with new BMPs.
Madam Chair.
Senator Anderson.
Mr. Stoddard, for the activities in these categories that you're already doing, where does the funding come from? Any particular fund? Or is it general fund dollars?
Madam Chair, Senator Anderson, most of the funding that we do in this area comes from fees on fertilizer registration.
And so, Mr. Stoddard, those fees aren't sufficient to allow you to do it at a level that you think will be necessary to fully implement your plan?
Madam Chair, that's correct. Those fees have multiple uses. They're used for reviewing permits, bulk storage, facilities, we do licensing, we do emergency response. They're used for a wide variety of different activities. The environmental aspect of the fee is just one part of what they're used for.
And Madam Chair.
Senator Anderson.
When were those fees last changed or increased?
Madam Mr. Chair, Stoddard. Senator Anderson, we just had a fee increase, I believe it was 2 years ago.
I should just point out since Senator Rummel, yeah, you've been part of this discussion, of course, yeah, and we've talked about trying to, in the agencies that we have in our division, trying to have the fee structure set up so that it covers the costs of the regulated areas or the permitted areas, and that's it's a long-term process to get there, but that's the goal that we are trying to accomplish so that we're not having the taxpayer subsidize everything in the state agencies and trying to limit that somewhat. Can I just ask one more question?
Absolutely, Senator Anderson.
You said you're going to look at trends. Are there other pesticides that are turning or fertilizer components that are turning up in drinking water besides nitrogen?
Madam Chair,
Mr.
Senator
Stoddard.
Anderson, not really. Nitrates are
nitrates,
primary problem from fertilizer and drinking water.
No,
but there are no other chemicals that are of concern? Or?
Madam Chair, we also regulate pesticides. We do routinely find low levels of pesticides in shallow groundwater, and we do monitoring and work closely with the other agencies to evaluate responses. But those levels are virtually always below the health standard. We do have best management practices developed for those, and we are promoting those also.
Madam Chair, if I could add that there is a request with the Clean Water Fund for our department in terms of pesticides. You didn't hear about it today because the pesticide request, while it will have drinking water benefits, it also has surface water benefits. So it's multifaceted. I think you'll see benefits on both sides. It'll feed into the impaired waters process and surface waters, but also benefit potentially. We'll be sampling both surface and groundwater for pesticides.
Thank you, Mr. Martin and Mr. Stoddard. And are you going to continue, Mr. Stein?
Yes, I'm sort of the... You're
the MC.
MC. And Mr. Japson, Department of Natural Resources, has a few slides to present relative to the DNR's role in drinking water protection.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Jim Japs, the Assistant Director for the Department of Natural Resources Division of Waters. And as Commissioner Stein pointed out, DNR has the primary responsibility for managing Minnesota's water supplies, obviously drinking water protection and sustainability.
Mr. Japs, would you pull the mic a little closer?
Absolutely. Thank you.
Drinking
water protection and sustainable water management are obviously linked, and it requires an understanding of water availability. This first slide shows the three outcome areas that we're looking at to protect drinking water supplies through water supply planning, water level monitoring, and aquifer protection. The general approach we're going to take is to identify areas with potential water supply issues and then work with the local units of government to develop plans that address those issues of concern and sustainable growth. We're going to develop monitoring networks that are specific to the protection of drinking water supplies, and the request includes $375,000 in FY10 and $750,000 in FY11.
Mr. Japs, how much can $375,000 accomplish?
Initially, what we're looking at is splitting that into three areas, and again, those would be the water supply planning. We're hoping to, and I'm going to get into this a little bit if I could, but we're looking at some water supply planning, looking and identifying areas that are having problems, working with communities on technical studies that are needed to verify those problems, and then developing a monitoring network that can monitor the trends in those resources.
And so over time, how will these resources either grow or change?
Well, at this point, our approach is to first develop a monitoring plan, a statewide monitoring plan, so we'll have a plan that identifies the need and the priorities, so we'll be coming back with that. And then we're going to do the same thing with the water supply plan, identify areas in the state that do have issues, and then we'll prioritize that and come back and identify what the need is for that. So that's the approach we're taking first is let's see, you know, what our ultimate need is and then come back and talk to you about those.
So these dollars are step one?
Correct.
Okay. Go ahead.
The next slide shows two hydrographs. The first hydrograph shows public water supply use from 1985 to 2007. There also, in the blue line there, charts population trends. And the thing I want to point out there is that in 87, 88, in the drought, you see the high peaks that we had, primarily due to lawn watering because it was a drought year. And we're regularly exceeding those peak periods now. So demand for water has increased, and it's going to maintain and be high for the time being. And this really highlights the need for that first outcome I mentioned earlier was drinking water supply planning. And what we need to do is link the water supply planning with community plans for growth. And we want to start again with a systematic evaluation and identify areas with potential water supply problems. We've done this in the metro area with the Met Council as part of the Metro Master Water Supply Plan that Chris Elverum will be talking about in a little bit here. But we need to do that also out in greater Minnesota. And then we'll need to work with the communities on studies to verify the potential supply limits and evaluate water supply alternatives if necessary. The second hydrograph on the bottom right there is a hydrograph of groundwater levels for the Mount Simon-Hinckley Aquifer, which is an observation well that we have in the Savage area. And it shows long-term seasonal groundwater trends from 1971. And as you can see, there's an overall decline there, but it does show that there's some bounce there. On the bottom of that, we do show where the top of the Mount Simon Aquifer is, and there's still about 400 feet of head there, but we do have concern in those areas, and that points out the other outcome we're looking at, which is aquifer protection and the need to do technical studies to determine aquifer characteristics that support resource management plans. And that would include looking at surface and groundwater interactions, groundwater recharge, and things like that. And then we want to, from those studies, look at the development of resource protection thresholds that the local communities can then use for their planning purposes.
And Mr. Japs, just from my own background, where is the Mount Simon Aquifer?
Madam Chair, the Mount Simon-Hinckley Aquifer is the deepest aquifer in the metropolitan area. It actually it reaches from north of this city all the way through the southern part of this state. But it is the deepest aquifer in the metropolitan area. It does have special protection under Minnesota statutes to be used as a drinking water supply. A lot of communities were using the Mount Simon Aquifer just for lawn watering purposes. And so part of the 1989 Groundwater Act, there was additional protections that provided that just for drinking water purposes.
And is that aquifer, can that aquifer be replenished? Some aquifers, I understand, are underneath impervious rock and cannot be replenished. Can that aquifer be replenished with rain?
Madam Chair, as you can see, this is the deepest aquifer, and it does have some of those impervious surfaces, so it takes a little longer to recharge, so it's a little bit more reactive to the withdrawals in that regard.
Thank you.
The final slide is just an overview of our observation well network that we have in Minnesota, and it's overlying on the County Geologic Atlas is that we have currently in the works and completed. This gets down to, you know, you can't measure or you can't manage what you don't measure. And we have about 750 active observation wells in the state. The outcomes that we plan on this part of the proposal would be to identify monitoring needs and priorities for the state, expand the network. We have a target of 1,250 wells as a minimum network. And then we also want to automate the wells with data loggers to get better data. Right now we contract with soil and water conservation districts and get 10 to 12 measurements a year. And with these data loggers, we can get daily or more frequent measurements, and so we'll get a much better set of data from those wells.
So if I understand you correctly, you currently have 750 observation wells, and your goal is to get to 1,250?
That's correct.
And how long will it take to get to that?
We have a plan that's laid out that would be 8 years. That's all I have, Madam Chair. I just threw the County Geologic Atlas program up there just to show where we are in the progress of that effort. It does provide the foundation for understanding water availability in Minnesota. We also have products there that are useful in the wellhead protection plans for the Department of Health to understand the relative sensitivity of an aquifer to pollution.
Mr. Japs, can you give us an idea of the average cost per observation well? And also, do these wells monitor both the quantity and the quality of the water?
Madam Chair, the wells are constructed to monitoring standards. They are an environmental borehole technically, but we construct them to monitoring standards. So they can be used for water quality monitoring, and that, again, those would be taken by the health department the Department of Ag or Pollution Control Agency. Mm-hmm. So we do coordinate with them on the plan that we're going to be putting together on where the needs are for these wells.
And it looks
the costs vary considerably. Okay. We just completed a well in Chanhassen that was down in the Mount Simon-Hinckley Aquifer, and that was over $100,000. I believe it was $117,000. But we do have a shallow drilling rig that can put in water table wells at fairly inexpensive compared to that cost. But I would say an average cost would be $15,000 to $20,000.
Will these wells be monitoring other watersheds, other aquifers besides the Mount Simon-Hinckley?
Madam Chair, what we like to do is we like to make a nest of wells, so we would have one deep well and one shallow well, or possibly more wells depending upon the aquifers that are present. So we like to make a little nest of wells where possible.
So that you're addressing all the aquifers in a given area?
That's correct.
Other questions? Thank you, Mr. Jaffs.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, we'll move on to the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, and Ms. Shannon Lothammer will come and present their information.
Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Shannon Lothammer. I'm the manager of the Water Monitoring Section at the Pollution Control Agency. And as Commissioner Stein noted earlier, the Pollution Control Agency focuses on the effects of non-agricultural contaminants in groundwater. So the next two slides are going to provide an overview of the PCA's component of the coordinated proposal for drinking water. And I should mention that the monitoring data that we collect is used for water supply planning, for wellhead protection efforts, and for BMP development, among other uses. So the first outcome of the PCA's proposal is to enhance the monitoring of vulnerable aquifers to better understand how water quality in these aquifers varies with land use, and also to identify water quality trends over time. Secondly, is to provide data on the presence of endocrine disrupting chemicals in drinking water sources. And again, we would be focusing on those shallow aquifers, those more vulnerable aquifers, which often some of those aquifers are used for drinking water sources, and in some cases they're kind of the surface aquifers that overlie some of the deeper drinking water sources, and in that case can serve as more of an early warning system of contaminants that are starting to enter our groundwater system. So we'd be coordinating very closely with the Department of Health on that EDC monitoring effort.
So if I understand you correctly, Ms. Lothammer, is it Lothammer?
Lothammer. So good German name. It's
okay.
Close enough.
The shallower aquifers are the most vulnerable in terms of these chemicals.
They're most vulnerable, Madam Chair, they're most vulnerable in the sense that the travel time is shorter in order to get to those shallow aquifers. So we tend to see, if contamination is starting to enter our groundwater system, we tend to see it first in the shallow aquifers. So that's why the PCA is focusing on that area in order to kind of get that early indication so we can identify where we might be having issues and start to put best management practices in place to avoid long-term issues.
Is there a danger when wells are drilled through those shallower aquifers down to lower ones of bringing contaminants down?
I can talk about that, Madam Chair. Yes, that is a risk. That's why we have a well code in this state that regulates the construction of new wells. Properly constructed, a new well will not introduce contaminants to deeper aquifers. Improperly constructed, they can be conduits. That's why the inventory of existing sources and wells and some of the work that the agencies do in concert is so important to identify those risks and hazards. I might also supplement just in this conversation relative to risk to drinking water, a chemical that enters shallow drinking water may be bound in that shallow water by the nature of the particles in the aquifer, whereas some chemicals move more readily with water over time and space. So it's not necessarily true that one rule applies to every contaminant. That's why the agency's expertise is really important. Pollution Control Agency's expertise is in industrial chemicals, industrial compounds, and waste products that have entered the groundwater system. The Department of Health is looking at, once it comes out of the tap, what are the risks to people? Mm-hmm. And that's sometimes these subtle distinctions are why the confusion begins. The Department of Agriculture is experts on how agricultural chemicals get into groundwater and migrate and are used. So that's, again, I just wanted to take that opportunity to talk about the different roles that the agencies play and why we do all have, when you see dots on a map, it looks like they all line up. In fact, they don't, because where the pollution control is applying their expertise is a different place than where the Department of Agriculture is applying its expertise.
Thank you. That was helpful. Ms. Loghammer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the third bullet then on this slide focuses on providing support to the total maximum daily load studies where groundwater and surface water interactions affect water quality. So really trying to enhance our understanding of that groundwater-surface water interaction. And then finally, as an element of all three of these outcomes is increasing the accessibility to our groundwater quality data through the internet so that that information is provided to stakeholders and also for the general public that's interested in water quality issues as well. Then this next slide provides more details about the PCA's proposed ambient monitoring enhancements. The map that you see shows the location of existing wells that the Pollution Control Agency is currently sampling. And then overlaid with that is the vulnerable aquifers, which are the focus of the Pollution Control Agency's monitoring network. And we rely on those existing wells wherever possible. For example, you heard Mr. Japs talk about the observation wells that the Department of Natural Resources puts in place and where those wells coincide with the superficial aquifers that we're looking to monitor and with the land uses that we're looking to see how the groundwater varies with that land use. We use those existing wells rather than looking at drilling a new well. So we really try to maximize that coordination and that collaboration and provide that efficiency.
Would there be any value in having some, at least one, if not two wells up there in the Northeast?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Neglected.
And Madam Chair, actually, you anticipated my next comment because, as you can see, that there are many areas in the state with vulnerable aquifers where we don't currently have existing wells that can be used for monitoring purposes. So the recommended funding would allow the Pollution Control Agency to install wells in these areas. In order to evaluate the impacts of different types of land use, we would focus on the non-agricultural land use since the Department of Agriculture is focusing on the agricultural land uses, and look at sewered communities, unsewered communities, commercial, industrial areas, and then also open space.
Now, is there anything you're currently doing that provides that function? In other words, how are you funding these wells that you already have?
Sure. Madam Chair, we currently have the ability to, we have resources to do the monitoring for about 100 wells per year. What we lack is the resources to install additional wells. And so we've been relying on existing wells, existing shallow monitoring wells, whether they're observation wells that meet our criteria or wells that were installed for other studies like U.S. Geological Survey wells that they've allowed us to use for monitoring purposes. The other source of wells that we use currently is there are a number of wells that are installed in association with remediation projects. So to help get a sense for the extent of contamination and then track those remediation efforts. And we have currently been relying on those wells as a part of this network. We actually recently completed an evaluation of the data that we're receiving from that well network. And what we're seeing, which isn't a surprise, actually, but is that the data that we're getting from that well network is really skewed towards the presence of petroleum types of contamination because those wells associated with remediation sites tend to be in those commercial and industrial areas. So we're really heavily represented in commercial industrial land uses. We're underrepresented in our current network with open space, residential, sewered, and unsewered areas. And so this proposal then would be to provide the resources to allow us to really get a better sense for land use and address that issue of relying on existing wells currently is kind of skewing our data towards a certain type of land use. And overall, then, the goal is to develop a network of 200 shallow wells for water quality, condition, and trend monitoring. We currently have about 50 wells that meet that desired goal, so it would be to install those additional 150 wells. And we would work very closely with other agencies and local government to coordinate that well installation so that wherever possible, we could meet multiple uses or needs from those monitoring wells, such as observation well needs as well as water quality monitoring needs.
I apologize. I didn't get the number of wells you want to.
Sure. Madam Chair, it would be an additional 150 wells.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, if there are no other questions for Ms. Lotthammer, bring Mr. Elverum.
Thank you, Mr. Stein.
Mr. Elverum is works with the Metropolitan Council, and he's going to wrap up our presentation today.
Welcome, Mr. Elverum.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Chris Elverum. I'm the Water Supply Planning Manager for the Metropolitan Council. The Met Council is in the final stages of approval of a regional water supply plan for the seven-county metropolitan area. And for that plan, we have done an extensive analysis of water supply availability, looking at both groundwater and surface water. That plan has concluded that if traditional supplies are relied upon, there will be issues associated with development and future use of those sources. Those issues, we also have concluded that we're not going to run out of water based on our projected growth, but those issues are going to be things like impacts to surface water features and trout streams and wetlands, things we've already seen, and as we put more pressure on our aquifer system, we'll see more of. There's also some risks to the aquifers in some areas where they aren't as productive of being drawn down to a dangerous level. We have also concluded that there are options available to address those issues, and those range from things like using a different aquifer, connecting with neighbors, using surface waters where those are available. But the key to this and the key to our plan is an ongoing evaluation and assessment. The plan recognizes that we have done as robust a job as we can. We have a lot of information relative to other parts of the state. We have a lot of wells and geologic information, but we're also have a lot of pressure on the system, and it's a complex system. So as we generate more information, we can improve our estimation of growth, improve our understanding of the availability and potential impacts, and develop options to meet those needs. So the plan provides guidance. It also develops, it also lays out a framework for ongoing evaluation and planning. Just to give you a sense of what this plan has shown, this shows the drawdown in 2030 in the Perry Duchesne Jordan Aquifer. So we assume that communities would continue to use that aquifer where it's available, and based on their population growth, they need a certain amount of water to serve that growth. The area shown in red are the areas where the drawdown would reach a level or a threshold that's been used by the DNR before that would require some action. And in so our plan, what it does is it lays out for those communities what those actions will be. They'll know that if they continue down that path, that they could potentially reach that level, so there's actions now they can take to avoid getting to that situation where the DNR would have to limit appropriations. So those actions are start with monitoring, and there's already a pretty good monitoring network. Some communities may have to add monitoring wells. Some of the monitoring wells that the other agencies have talked about will meet those needs as well. But those communities now have, with this plan, a path to understand or to know what the steps they will need to take to ensure their supplies are developed, and that the agencies will have a level of comfort in permitting those future appropriations.
Mr. Elverum, could you give us some other examples of what those actions might be?
Sure. Madam Chair, in most cases it starts with monitoring because we relied on a groundwater model, which is a really good tool for this regional assessment, but I wouldn't rely on it for a specific impact to a specific feature on a very local scale. So in order to determine if your pumping is going to impact this well, it'd be monitoring of groundwater levels and potentially of a surface water feature. Ultimately, too, it will require or result in some additional planning. So the communities will have to, if this issue is raised, they'll have to start developing now plans to serve their demand in the future. So it will be things like working with their neighbors early on. So in their development, they can plan their pipe size and their tanks and things so that they can share supplies more easily. And also, of course, conservation is an important part of this plan. It's built in so that for all communities, and especially those that are going to face some issues, there will be some level of conservation and water efficiency anticipated or expected of those suppliers before they develop those supplies.
Madam Chair, can I ask a question now?
Senator Anderson.
Thank you. Is this all pretty much in terms of trying to find more efficiencies for water use, are you saying that's all going to be left to the local level, or is the Met Council going to develop any broader recommendations for how to reduce our consumption of water or use it more efficiently?
Madam Chair and Senator
Mr.
Anderson,
Elverum.
The plan at this point lays out tools for the communities. We actually have a water conservation toolbox that we developed as part of this. And so it is left to the local suppliers, and we haven't gone that step that you're asking about. And that was one of the things that we deliberated with our Water Supply Advisory Committee. Mr. Stein was a member of that committee. And at this point, I think that the DNR and the Met Council can provide some guidance and some things. Here are the actions communities should be taking, but it's left to the local level at this point for those decisions. If down the road there is some desire or some support for a more regional approach to that, I think we would be willing to help with that effort. But at this point, that was not a popular a popular idea.
And Madam Chair,
Senator Anderson,
I'm just wondering how far, you know, how deep you're going in your recommendations or your toolbox that you're providing to these communities. I mean, are you? Does anybody know how much water is lost from impervious surfaces that are just channeled somewhere outside of, you know, down a river somewhere? Does anyone measure that? I mean, and what a difference it would make to reduce the amount of impervious surfaces? Or is anyone looking at reuse of water or changing building codes to require reuse or any of those kinds of policy changes?
Madam Chair and Senator Anderson,
Mr. Stein,
serving on the advisory committee, I want to tell you what kind that we did have conversations about every one of those subjects. And as Mr. Elverum noted, I think the point that the council's plan reached was the point of acceptance of all the partners in the process to this point. There are a number of unanswered questions about recharge to groundwater, and there are a number of concerns about water reuse. There are water chemistry and public health issues associated with reusing water systems. That's an issue that is a higher priority where water is more scarce. In the West, in areas along the coast where water supplies are at risk, it's a much higher priority. I would say that all of the concerns you just raised were vetted through the conversations on the plan. I would expect if the council continues to its effort to develop this plan, implement the plan with the communities, that those conversations are going to continue. In fact, some of the studies that the council has debated engaging in are about lost recharge as a result of runoff. Another example is the opportunities lost by not expanding our surface water systems. There are groundwater systems that are expanding, and we have capacity in the metropolitan area for surface water use to increase. And so those conversations are, I would call them ripening, but not to the extent that perhaps you're envisioning. So we need to work with the partners on this planning process, I believe, to continue that.
And building on Senator Anderson's concern, I noticed that this graphic is 2030, which is really not that far out. We're in other parts of our committee work dealing with the issues related to global warming and how will that impact the whole ecosystem, let alone our water supply, and the demands that may be put on us by other states who are not as blessed as we are with waters. So this is a major concern. We really have to think out much further than 2030, and I would welcome that those ripening conversations ripen quickly, because I think things are moving fast.
Madam Chair, the agencies and the partners for the Met Council Advisory Committee that worked on the water supply plan would agree with you. Communities have different perspectives, and those communities have a voice, and we listened. The planning horizon that the council used was 2050. Mm-hmm. So there were a number of folks expressing the same concern that you did, which is that's a fairly short planning horizon given the projections on climate change. And I would agree that we need to have more conversation about that.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, I might add too that the part of this plan, I think, that is going to help with that is that we set up a, we have a set of tools now. We have a base of technical information, and we actually have a, you know, we have the conversation going. And so the ongoing effort, we can start running those scenarios. We can look at, well, what if 2100 and we have a 10-year drought, or what if overall rainfall is increased or decreased? How can that affect the system? And we so I think that's really what our request or the governor's request for the Met Council would do. It would continue to improve our understanding of the aquifers through these kind of measurements and additional geologic mapping, and then also start evaluating different scenarios and start to really look at down the line how can we plan to ensure that we don't run into issues in the future. And finally, I would just show an example of how this plan is going to be used. We have developed a community water supply profile for each community. It identifies some information about their water supply system, about their water use, their available sources, and then identifies the issues. And then the community would take that water supply profile, go to another section of the plan, which identifies those steps which we discussed earlier, how to address those issues.
Madam Chair, that's the conclusion of our presentation, and I appreciate the opportunity to be here today.
What impeccable timing as we lose one of our key senators. You wrap up. Are there any additional questions? I'd like to thank you, Assistant Commissioner Stein, and Assistant Commissioner Wood. Is it Wood?
Flood.
I'm sorry. For coordinating this and for keeping it as precise and tight as you have. And I'm sure that we will have lots of questions as we proceed, but I really appreciate the thorough and coordinated conversation that you've created for us. So thank you very, very much. This has been terrific. So with that, I will adjourn the subcommittee.